You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, this is Robin Johnson, and welcome back to another edition of The Best of Heartland Politics, a radio show I began in 2014 that's now a regular podcast and show on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. Scott Eyman is one of the best writers on the Golden Age of Hollywood, and listeners may be familiar with Scott from his numerous appearances on Turner Classic Movies. But what I like best about his work is how he blends in themes related to the larger world around his subjects, and especially American culture. Scott wrote what is the best biography of John Wayne, and he was my guest back in 2016 to talk about his book. It's called John Wayne, The Life and Legend, and it explored Wayne's roots in Iowa, including his birth in Winterset, where his birthplace museum still exists, and his brief stay near to here in Keokuk. But the reason I especially like this book and included it as one of my best was the story about Wayne's reaction to the movie High Noon and how that movie depicted America in his eyes. He went so far as to push for a movie with a counter-narrative, which Eyman recounts in the book and in this interview. Eyman also addresses the paradox that Wayne, a hero in so many war movies and westerns, never served in the U.S. military. So I hope you enjoy this interview with Scott Eyman, who chronicles one of the most admired actors in the history of film, John Wayne. Hi, everyone. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and welcome to Talking Politics. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And today, at the end of a tumultuous and unpredictable and lively political year, we're concluding 2016 with something totally different. I think you're going to enjoy this. We're going to take a break from the Donald Trump era, the fiscal mess in Illinois, and the leadership transition in Iowa to focus on a native son of the Hawkeye State, his career as one of the most famous movie stars in American history, and because our focus is on politics here, his political views and involvement. That American icon is John Wayne. And here to talk about him is Scott Eyman, who authored what I think is Wayne's definitive biography called John Wayne, The Life and Legend, which was just published a couple of years ago. And we're going to talk politics, but I guarantee all our listeners here, we will talk movies here too. Scott, hey, welcome, and thank you very much for taking the time to be on today.
Well, thanks for having me, Robin.
First of all, just talk a little bit about your background and what led you to write a biography of John Wayne.
Well, that was a long road. I met him when I was 21. I sat in a dressing room at CBS with him for, 75 minutes, maybe 90 minutes. He was shooting a TV special at CBS, and I was a kid with no credentials, whatever. And I'd written him a letter. His office was at Paramount Studios. Backjack Productions was at Paramount at that era. And I'd written him a letter, and his secretary had written me back saying, well, if you ever come to California, I was living in Ohio at that point, if you ever come to California, let me know. So that was all the encouragement I needed. About 6 weeks later, I showed up in Los Angeles, and I called his secretary, Mary St. John, sainted woman, and she said, oh, well, tomorrow he's shooting a show at CBS. Could you be over at CBS? I said, yeah, sure. And what I didn't know, because I thought, well, this is lucky. Well, it was a little bit more than luck. I mean, I wrote a good letter, but that wasn't why she was getting me in to see him. He didn't like to be alone. He was a very gregarious guy by nature, and his idea of hell was sitting alone in a room with no one to talk to. So even if I was a dumb kid, I'd written a reasonably intelligent letter, and better to have a dumb kid with some knowledge of old movies to talk to someone to talk to than to leave him alone in a room, you know. So I lucked out, basically. And I had a great time with him, and he was the guy on screen, but he wasn't the guy on screen. There was an interesting duality about him. He was much friendlier, much calmer, more self-effacing than he ever was on screen. And he wanted you to be at ease. I mean, he'd been John Wayne for a long time, and he was used to people being intimidated by him because of his size, because of his aura, because of his charisma, because of his movie star thing. And he had worked out a way to make people feel comfortable in very short order so that he could they could respond to each other as people rather than as a public and a movie star. It was very interesting to watch him do it. It was interesting at the time, even though I was only a kid. And it's especially interesting in retrospect. And the years went by, and I started to write. And I wrote books about the movies, and I wrote several books about John Ford, his great pal and mentor and father figure. And I kind of avoided the idea of doing a book on John Wayne because there were several. I didn't honestly think they were very good. But I didn't really want to go riding out in the Monument Valley again, metaphorically speaking. On the other hand, during the course of writing my books about Ford, I had gotten a lot of interviews with people who were now dead, who had worked with Wayne over and over and over again. So I had all this material on John Wayne. And I wasn't getting any younger. And finally I decided, well, if I'm going to do it, I better do it before I'm senile, you know? So I finally sat down. Yeah. I finally sat down and did it. And I'm glad I did because the book made the New York Times bestseller list. And people loved it. And the reviews were spectacular. And I think it kind of hit the reset button for the critical appreciation of John Wayne.
It's a great book. I really enjoyed it. And I had some knowledge of John Wayne, but not nearly as much as what you got into in this book. And one of the areas I think most people, when they hear John Wayne, they think of his movies, and they would have some familiarity that he was born in Iowa. And by the way, for our listeners out there, I went to Winterset, to his museum over the summer, and it's really well done. I really encourage people to go. But talk about his upbringing in Iowa. And one thing I didn't know was that he spent some time here in Southeast Iowa.
He moved around a lot. He was born in Winterset. He was there for a couple of years, 2 to 3 years, and then they started moving around. They moved to about 3 more places in Iowa before they moved out to California. His father was a pharmacist assistant. And in that era when professional licensing was, shall we say, lax, I mean, Wayne was born in 1907, and professional licensing was nowhere near as stringent as it is today, I have no doubt that his father was essentially working as a pharmacist. The house he was born in is tiny, as you saw. Mm-hmm. Might be 800 square feet in total, 900 square feet, very small. It's a Sears house, one of those houses that were dumped off the railroad car, and then you had to hire a carpenter to put it together. But basically, it was you paid $800 or something for it, and you had a house a month later. And it's still standing. So it was a rental. They never owned a house. His father was not terribly successful. He was successful as a human being, not successful as a businessman ever. As I said, they hopscotched around Iowa, and then they moved to Palmdale, which is right on the edge of the Mojave Desert in California, where he attempted to farm. And it was blatantly insane to try to farm on the edge of the Mojave Desert, but nevertheless, his father did. That lasted about 2 years. The marriage broke up. Duke's parents' marriage broke up as a result of the stresses and strains of the economic problems they were having. And they weren't terribly well matched anyway. And at that point, they moved to Glendale, where they again moved every year, almost every year. If you follow the path of the Morrison family, his real name was Marion Morrison. If you follow the path of Marion Morrison family in the city directories of Glendale, they're moving constantly because I don't think they couldn't afford to buy, and people raise the rents, and when the people would raise the landlords would raise the rents, they'd have to move to another house. So it was a very peripatetic, rootless existence for Wayne's first 12 years, 13 years. When they got to Glendale, even though they were moving around a lot in Glendale, he kind of found himself. He started playing sports. He shot up. He learned how to take care of himself. His natural athletic ability manifested itself, and he became an athlete, a young athlete. He played on a high school football team. They were an excellent high school football team at Glendale High, and it got him a scholarship to USC on the football team, which was fortuitous because there's no earthly way that he would have been able to afford to go to USC on a straight tuition basis. At that point, his goal was to be a lawyer. But because, again, he was broke because there was no money, he needed a summer job, and he wangled a summer job at Fox Studios. which was not too far away from the USC campus. Mm-hmm. So he was a prop boy. He was a general dog's body. He'd lift stuff. He was just one of the young guys around the lot with a strong back and strong arms. They had a lot of the football players at USC that got summer jobs at Fox because the football coach at USC was a guy named Howard Jones, and he was close friends with Tom Mix, the leading Cowboy star at the studio, and John Ford, one of the leading directors at the studio. So that's how a lot of the USC football players ended up at Fox. That's where also Ward Bond, who was on the same team as Wayne was, lower level, but still playing on the USC football team. But he and Wayne and Bond were both working summer jobs at Fox. At that point, after 2 years on the football team on a scholarship, Wayne messed up his shoulder surfing. He had a surfing accident. He took a tumble. It messed up his shoulder. He was a lineman on the USC football team, and a lineman who can't block, and he was going to miss at least a year while the shoulder healed. A lineman who can't block is basically useless. So there went his football scholarship. Mm-hmm. So there went his career at USC. Mm-hmm. So there went his ambitions for law. As it happened, he'd gotten really entranced by the movie business, working in close proximity with people like John Ford. And so he kind of just switched over to a full-time job at Fox, working his way up the ladder. Ford spotted him. They became very friendly. Ford put him in a couple pictures in bit parts. You know, gave him a close-up here and there. And eventually, Raoul Walsh hired him to make The Big Trail, big epic Western, shot in 1930.
I thought it was interesting that, as you mentioned in the book, he worked his way up. He started at the bottom, his way up. And is that related? One of the things I wanted to ask you was his upbringing, and he spent some time in Keokuk here in southeast uh-huh. Iowa, a brief period uh-huh. of time his family did. But those Iowa roots and working his way up, what role did that have in shaping his career, who he was, and then his political beliefs?
Well, the core of his political belief was self-reliance. His basic train of logic went, I started out with nothing. My parents had nothing. It wasn't a pleasant home environment. They ended up getting a divorce. I was basically thrown onto my own recognizance to survive, and I did, and I've done just fine. Why can't everybody else? Mm-hmm. That was basically his train of logic. And as far as it went, that was fine. But as Katharine Hepburn observed after they worked together in Rooster Cogburn, he doesn't seem to realize that he had this enormously powerful locomotive in terms of his personality, in terms of his drive to succeed, in terms of his talent, frankly. He's a wonderful actor. Mm-hmm. Not everybody has that size of a locomotive powering them, you know? And he didn't make a lot of adjustments in his estimations for depending upon whether or not, upon drive. He didn't really take that into account. He figured if I can make it, anybody can make it. And his values were always Midwestern values. He was never a creature of either coast. He was never a creature of the East Coast, and he wasn't even that much a creature of the West Coast, even though he spent two-thirds of his life in California between when he moved there as a young boy, a pubescent boy, in Glendale, and then the movie thing takes off, and he spends the rest of his life in and around Los Angeles. Of course, he ended up in Newport Beach for the last 14 or 15 years of his life. But his values were always those of the Midwest. So when he became a star and began making serious money, he gravitated towards those areas that most closely replicated the values of the Midwest and of Iowa, which in that era meant Orange County in California, which is why he ended up in Newport. One of the reasons he ended up in Newport Beach. Another reason he ended up in Newport Beach was that he loved the water. He loved the sea. He had a converted minesweeper for a yacht. And he had a house right on the bay in Newport Beach, so he could watch the boats come in and go out all day long, which gave him enormous pleasure.
You're listening to Talking Politics on KBUR AM 1490, FM 99.3. This is Robin Johnson. Our host today is author Scott Eyman, who wrote the definitive biography, I think it's fair to say, on John Wayne. John Wayne, the life and legend. We're talking a little bit about John Wayne's background, his values, that were so appealing to middle America. I saw you use that phrase, Scott, and it just made me think immediately of politics and how this election went in the Midwest and how he really was. He had a connection here with middle America.
Absolutely.
The other interesting thing was the whole Western. And I really – one thing about your book, and I really – you know, listeners out there who haven't gotten their Christmas shopping done, here you go. This is a great book about an American film icon, but it's also about a history of the film industry, and it gets into a lot of the aspects of film and culture and relating to people, which I thought was one of the best, most interesting parts of the book for me. But the American Western, talk about that a little bit, its role in our history and John Wayne's role specifically in making the Western so popular.
Well, the Western was very popular in the silent era. You had huge Western stars like William S. Hart and Tom Mix in different ways. William S. Hart made serious movies about serious people, and they were on the surface extremely realistic. You know, the physical settings of William S. Hart's movies were very realistic. The towns were kind of crummy looking, and the dance hall girls were obviously prostitutes, and the gamblers were pretty sleazy. And I mean, the costuming and the use of the guns and the physical look was extremely realistic. And you also had extremely popular Western stars like Tom Mix and Buck Jones, who were more showmanship, sort of Cecil B. DeMille version of the Western hero, where there was a lot of roping and riding and not that much serious gunplay, and they were aimed at a lower audience, at a more juvenile audience. And that dichotomy began to dissipate in sound, because for a while in sound, Westerns were dead. After when Wayne made The Big Trail in 70 millimeter, and it was extraordinarily expensive, and they shot it all over the West, mostly in Montana, Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and areas of Montana, and also areas of California. But they were going places where a film crew had never been, and it was very arduous and very expensive, and it was supposed to be – Fox was positioning Wayne as the Tom Mix of the sound era. Unfortunately, the film dropped dead, and nobody went to see it. So that went his starring career in big-budget films. So for the next 8 years, 9 years, he slaved away in B-movies, which were the equivalent on a lower level of the Tom Jones, of the Tom Mix, Buck Jones pictures that he'd grown up, that Wayne had grown up watching as a kid in Glendale. But Westerns didn't really take off and be taken seriously until the late 30s, when DeMille got into them with Union Pacific and The Plainsman, and John Ford decided to go back to the Western that he'd begun in 12 years before. No, 22 years before. I'm sorry. He started directing Westerns in 1917, and then as he got more successful, he kind of dropped the genre after 1926. Didn't make it Western from 1926 to 1939, and then decided it was time to go back to Westerns. And he made Stagecoach and hired Wayne, lifted Wayne up out of the morass of cheap Westerns that he'd been in, and he was basically a star overnight, all over again. You know, they tried to make him a star in 1930. It didn't take, but it did take when John Ford made Stagecoach. And at that point, the Western really started to define itself, its values, its look. John Ford brought Monument Valley, and Monument Valley became the signature landscape of the American West. And if you go to Monument Valley today, you know, 80 and 90 years after these films were made, you find mostly Japanese tourists, European tourists, far more than American tourists. But, you know, all over the world, Monument Valley became the American West. And even now, all these years later, this is what Europeans and Japanese want to see. They want to see where those films were made, where John Wayne and John Ford collaborated in those movies.
So Stagecoach was really the key movie in bringing the modern Western, if you want to call it that, into being with John Ford and John Wayne.
Yes, and also in terms of the complexity of the characters and the interactions of the characters on a very adult level. Mm-hmm. And it was gorgeously directed and beautifully photographed. It was one of those movies where everything coalesces and everything works. Most movies, there's usually a problem. The script's not right, or the actors aren't very interesting, or there's always something you can point to is not really working. But in Stagecoach, everything works. The acting's great. The characters are great. The script is excellent. Ford is at the top of his game. And Wayne delivers. Ford builds the film around Wayne, and he delivers. So it brought Wayne onto a different level, and it started to bring the Western to a different level.
One thing I noticed in the book, too, you talked about his relationship with Orson Welles, who was probably diametrically opposed to John Wayne politically. But yeah. as you said, personality trumped politics, and maybe that's something our politicians can learn today, is that he didn't let it get in the way of friendships and meaningful relationships.
Never. He was very, as I said, he was extremely gregarious. And if you were amusing and if you were witty and if you could give him a good game of chess, He would have played chess with Vladimir Lenin if he could give him a good game of chess. his needs as a man overrode his needs as a political theoretician. He and Welles liked each other quite a bit, but that was because Welles worshipped John Ford. Basically, Welles worshipped John Ford, and anybody who worshipped John Ford was aces in John Wayne's book because John Wayne worshipped John Ford.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, as you talked before, his Middle America values, conservative politics. He usually favored the more conservative candidate. The one controversy in his career, and my dad, who was a veteran, always brought this up, was about his lack of military service. Here he was playing heroes in war movies, westerns. He was viewed kind of as a hypocrite by the left, but the right still viewed him as a hero and welcomed him. Discuss that issue of his deferments during World War II and kind of his hesitancy to discuss this later in life.
Well, it was one of the scabs that he didn't like to pick at. John Ford enlisted in the Navy right after Pearl Harbor, as so many people did in the movie industry. I mean, the movie industry was like defenestrated by World War II because every able-bodied actor and director and writer, got into the war. It was a moral imperative to a great extent. Ford had his own unit attached to the Navy. It was called the Field Photo Service. Ford's only superior was Wild Bill Donovan, William Donovan, who's head of the OSS. And Ford's ostensible job was to be the photographic, do the photographic record of the Navy during the war. But they did a lot of reconnaissance work. They did a lot of reconnaissance photography. They did the reconnaissance photography for D-Day. Ford was there at D-Day. Ford was there at the Battle of Midway along with some of his men. So Ford had this extraordinary war. Wayne had this kind of boyish thing that he wanted to go work with Ford. And he had this contract at Republic, and he wrote Ford these letters, I want to get in. And Ford was kind of dismissive, well, if you want to get in, you know. Finally, Wayne goes to Washington to interview with Wild Bill Donovan. And Wild Bill Donovan turns him down because he didn't see that Wayne had any skills applicable to the function of the OSS. Well, at that point, Wayne could have punted. He could have dropped back 10 yards, gone into the Army, the Air Force, the Marines, the conventional Navy. He could have done any number of things. He did none of those things. He basically allowed Republic, which was the studio he was under contract to file deferments for him to the end of the war. Ford was very displeased by this. Because he thought, in Ford's letters to his wife, while he was in the service during the war, are very unhappy with Wayne. It's clear that he's lost respect for Wayne because Wayne, he feels, is malingering and making movies and being brave in the movies instead of being brave at the front. So Ford's not happy with him, and Wayne would certainly have understood that. Now, why does Wayne do this? Well, he never said. There's no letter. There's no interview where he comes clean about why he did what he did. So you have to intuit, what his thinking was. Now, what was going on? He had at this point, he had, I believe, four children. And he's making money for the first time in his life. And I think a lot of his self-image about John Wayne going to war was wrapped up in the idea of serving under Happy Ford, John Ford. Because he worshipped Ford. Ford was his father figure. Ford was his older brother. Ford was the male role model that he wanted to please. And when that was yanked away from him, when Donovan, one Wild Bill Donovan, basically refused to hire him for the OSS, I think he's just sort of just let it drop. He realized in later years that this was maybe not the correct action, but it wasn't something that he would bring up, you know, because he was embarrassed about it. I know several of his children. They all feel that a function of his growing political conservatism after the war was a way of dealing with his embarrassment, about making himself so red, white, and blue that he could never be questioned about this kind of thing and the fact that he hadn't served. We don't know exactly because, as I said, there is no letter where he explains his thinking. There was no interview where he explained his thinking. But I think a lot of it was wrapped up in his hero worship of John Ford and his unwillingness. He was willing to sacrifice the money he was making and his increasing success if he could work for his father figure. Failing that, I don't know that he had the driving urge. You know, if he'd had the urge, he certainly could have gone in.
One more question before we get to talking specifically about movies. Again, one of the most interesting things about this book was the story that I never knew, the story of the movie High Noon, which, as movie lovers know, famous Western with Gary Cooper. Wayne hated that movie and actually went about to create a different movie. Talk about that whole story and the reasons why.
Well, Wayne and Cooper were very friendly because Cooper was also conservative, but he wasn't political. You know, he voted Republican usually, but he was not involved as Wayne was involved in the post-war conservative Hollywood activities. And Wayne's beef with High Noon was basically pegged around Carl Foreman, who was the screenwriter. It was an original, not an original screenplay, but it was an adaptation of a short story by a writer named Carl Foreman, who had been a member of the Communist Party before or maybe just the beginning of World War II, and then had left the party and had become a successful screenwriter in the very late 1940s. And High Noon, and he'd written Champion for Kirk Douglas, and then he wrote High Noon. And High Noon became a huge hit. And because Foreman had been a communist in the party earlier, Wayne and most of the people in the Motion Picture Alliance, which was the conservative action movement in Hollywood at that point, in about 1950, regarded it as communist propaganda. Because the citizens of the town of, Hadleyville, are unwilling to help the sheriff, who's got four killers coming into town, and he's all by himself. And he's asking for help, and they refuse to help him. And he thought this was completely un-American, that any group of citizens in an American town would, in fact, stand up and help the law enforcement if they needed help. So he thought it was communist propaganda. Cooper thought that was ridiculous. He'd starred in the picture. He liked Carl Foreman a great deal. He thought it was an excellent script, and he never had the least amount of doubts about the movie during the production of the movie, or after the production of the movie. As it happened, the film became a huge hit, and Cooper got the Best Actor Oscar for his performance in High Noon. But Wayne had a real problem with the picture because of the way it portrayed the citizens, and by extension, American citizens, and also because the marshal, the Gary Cooper character, is frightened. He's afraid. He'd rather not die if he doesn't have to. And he's openly shaky about facing these four guys all by himself. And he thought that was between the portrayal of the townspeople and the portrayal of the marshal. He thought it was communist propaganda. So Foreman basically had to leave the country because he got blacklisted. Right after the film came out, he might have been out of the country, in fact, by the time the film came out, but it was right, you know, it was almost simultaneous. And he spent 15 years in England, and after an initially rough period, he ended up co-writing The Bridge on the River Kwai for David Lean. He didn't get credit because he was still blacklisted at that point, but then he wrote and produced Guns of Navarone, which was a huge hit. And he wrote and produced Born Free, another huge hit in the middle 60s. And so he ended up doing extraordinarily well for himself, and finally he came back to Hollywood in the 1970s. At which point he ran into John Wayne at a restaurant in Hollywood. And Foreman had a young English wife and his son with him that he had with his young English wife. And he and Wayne's eyes locked across a restaurant. And they started walking towards each other, and they threw open their arms and hugged each other. And Foreman's wife is looking at this, and she'd heard him railing about what a nasty SOB John Wayne was, and he'd driven me out of the country, and blah, 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 blah. She'd been listening to this for years, you know, in him telling his story of the blacklist period. And then Foreman brings Wayne over to the table, introduces Wayne to his wife and his child. Wayne, of course, was perfectly charming and just delightful. And they have this wonderful reunion, and then Wayne goes off to his table, and Foreman sits down, and she goes, "You want to explain this? What just happened to me?"
Yeah.
And Foreman goes, "He was a patriot, and I was a patriot. He didn't do what he did out of bitterness or envy. You know, he was sincere in his political beliefs. I was sincere in my political beliefs. They just happened to be different political beliefs." So at the end of the day, there weren't any grudges held. You couldn't say that about a lot of the people who were harmed by the blacklist, who basically went to their graves holding grudges against the people that helped blacklist them. But Foreman was able to get over it.
And in response to High Noon, Wayne went about and created one of the movies I liked.
Real Bravo. Sure. Yeah. His friend Howard Hawks, who'd made Red River with late in the 40s, he also was personally offended, who's also a Republican, and he was also offended by High Noon. So that started the idea percolating basically to do a story about a sheriff who basically doesn't want anybody else's help. He'll carry on regardless, you know, even though he's outnumbered and outgunned, you know. So it's basically a loose response to High Noon on the part of Hawks and Wayne.
Okay, we just got a little bit of time left, but let's go through. I'm going to put you on the spot here on some of the movies Wayne made. I don't want to ask for the top 10. You list in the book in the beginning some of the what you consider the best movies, but what do you consider his best, say, three or four? If you can do that, the best works he did over the course of his career.
Oh, I like The Searchers, of course. Everybody does. I like She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. I like Red River, partially because he made both of them within about a year of each other, and they're completely diametrically opposed personalities. You know, in She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, he's gentle. He's trying to avoid war. He tries to avoid getting people killed, Indians and soldiers alike. He's an agent of peace and trying to settle things down. In Red River, which is a dry run for the Searchers, he's a very harsh, unforgiving Old Testament character. Wayne could play Old Testament. Wayne could play New Testament. And towards the end of his life, in movies like True Grit and The Shootist, he kind of combined the two into characters who had very, very gentle aspects, but could also settle a score if need be. So I like The Searchers, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, Fort Apache, Red River. I like Three Godfathers, actually. I like it a lot. I love They Were Expendable a lot, a movie that when I saw it when I was a kid, I was, I don't know, 20 or something, 19 or 20. I didn't get it all. But the older I've gotten, the more I value it. And now I would put it, you know, on as high a level as any of the Westerns, frankly, the Western collaborations between Ford and Wayne.
He got his Oscar for his lead role in
True Grit.
True Grit. Sorry, by escaping me. Do you think that was the best acting job he did, or should he have gotten one for another movie?
Well, I think it's a delightful performance. I think the film works very well, and I think he's very good in it. No, I mean, they could have easily given him one for She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. They could have given him one for Red River. They could have given him one for The Searchers. They probably should have given him one for The Searchers. I don't remember who won it that year in 1956, but I can't imagine it was anywhere near as good as Wayne's performance in The Searchers. But as I said, he wasn't the favorite guy of the California establishment, of the movie establishment. He wasn't the favorite guy of the New York critical establishment. You know, True Grit was a kind of career award. That was it was a big hit. Everybody liked it. Young people went to see it. Old people went to see it. Everybody went to see it. It was a crowd pleaser. And this is a guy who'd been slogging away for 40 years making movies, and he'd made a lot of really good movies and given a lot of really good performances. So, you know, and he was also getting up in years. He was over 60 at this point. He was 62, 63 years old. So it was kind of a career achievement award. And also, frankly, I think he's very good in it. I like his performance in True Grit. Is it as scathing or as searching as the performance in The Searchers or Red River? No. But, you know, it was a popularity contest, and he was very popular by that time.
Is there, and this is our final question. We could talk easily another half hour, but I've got to cut it off here. But is there one question, Scott, where you think the movie as a whole and his role in it were underrated? I mean, everybody, when you hear John Wayne movies, you automatically think of True Grit and Red River. Mm-hmm. But is there one that you would recommend our listeners to go watch that maybe is kind of you regard as underrated that maybe wasn't as popular in box office receipts or in the public imagination?
Well, certainly they were expendable. What came out after the war was over. They were shooting it in the winter of 44-45, and it came out right after the war was over, and nobody wanted to see a World War II picture at the end of 1945. People had come through it. They were exhausted. The last thing they wanted to see was a movie about World War II. But it's one of the best pictures about World War II, you know, because it's about the reality, the emotional reality of war. It's not a particularly violent picture, but it's about the emotional reality of war it's not a question of clear-cut losing or clear-cut winning. It's just a question of surviving from one day to the next, just plodding ahead, one foot in front of the other. And at the end of the day, at the end of the movie, you don't even know what happens to one of the main characters. You know, she might be dead. She might be a prisoner of the Japanese. We don't know. And these men have to go on ahead and basically abandon their cohorts, the rest of the soldiers, because the officers are ordered to leave and leave the enlisted men behind. You know, they're following orders. They have to. There's a line in the film. Sometimes if the manager orders you to bunt and sacrifice a runner to second base, that's what you do. Even if it's not what you want to do, you do what the manager says. So they have to do these things because they're in the military and you're following orders. So it's a very adult recognition of the reality of war in a way that you didn't get from Hollywood then or even later, for that matter. And I think it just gets better and better with age, which can't be said of that many movies, really. A lot of movies show their age. They were expendable. It just looks better and better.
Real quick, are you working on another book? What's next for you?
I'm just finishing a book called Hank and Jim. It's something different for me. It's a book about the 50 year friendship between Henry Fonda and Jimmy Stewart, who met in 1932, roomed together in New York, went to Hollywood the same year, roomed together in Hollywood. Stayed best friends all their lives for the next 50 years. Very close. They played these involved practical jokes that took weeks to work up. Stewart was godfather to Fonda's children, Peter and Jane. They were just devoted friends to each other. And it's a much more intimate story, less about their work as actors, more about their value as human beings. And so I spent a lot of time with all the kids, Stewart's three kids, Jane and Peter Fonda, Fonda's widow, Shirley. So it's more emotional and less, and then he made. So it's a different kind of book, but I hope it works.
Great.
So Hank and Jim, it'll be out in a year.
Great. We'll be looking forward to it. Keep up your good work. Scott Iman, the author of John Wayne, The Life and Legend, has been our guest today. And again, folks, I hope our conversation today has piqued a little bit of interest. If you're still looking for a gift to get somebody, again, it's a biography, but it's a lot more than that. It's a history of film. There's some political stuff, a lot on Iowa in his early years. So there's a lot here to commend it, and it's very well written. And Scott, thank you again so much for being our guest today.
Anytime. Thanks very much.